You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, South Korea elects its first female president. We'll assess what this means for the country and for the region as a whole. And staying in Asia, we'll be joined by our Tokyo bureau chief, who'll go over this year's biggest stories.
It's so fresh in people's minds. And it's interesting, when people are asked, what do you care about? You know, nuclear power does, it's right up there. But when it came to the election, they didn't vote for anti-nuclear parties.
And our man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, will sample some of the finest wines on offer this festive season.
Easy, elegant. You can drink many, many, many. It's very drinkable, it's very vinoso.
All that, plus we'll talk to the man behind a book of photography that's so startling, commentators have questioned whether it's real. And our culture editor Robert Bound and I will be playing Snog, Marry, Avoid with the pictures in this winter's edition of The Alpino. And we'll play you some music too. That's all coming up here on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest world news headlines from Jonathan Wheatley.
The United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has today made an end-of-year speech at the UN headquarters in New York, outlining his continuing concerns over global conflicts, particularly the war in Syria and Mali.
Syria began the year in conflict and ends the year in war. Day by day, the death toll has climbed. Month by month, the regional spillover has grown. I'm deeply concerned about the increased militarization of the conflict and the potential for sectarian atrocities. The situation in Mali is especially urgent. We must do all we can to help Malians restore their democracy, recover their territory, address the humanitarian crisis, and end the shocking human rights violations.
Park Geun-hye will make an emotional return to South Korea's presidential mansion in February as South Korea's first female leader, more than three decades after she left it following the assassination of her father. The 60-year-old scored a decisive victory in the country's general election today, ensuring that South Korea's conservatives, who pushed through a free trade agreement with the United States, hold on to the powerful presidency for a second consecutive time after the end of incumbent Lee Myung-bak's mandatory single term in office. Afghanistan has today welcomed Britain's announcement that nearly half of its troops will be gone from the country by the end of 2013 as part of the ongoing handover to local forces. Prime Minister David Cameron said today that Britain will withdraw nearly half of its 9,000 soldiers from Afghanistan by the end of next year.
Because of the success of our forces and the Afghan National Security Forces, and the fact that we're moving from mentoring at a battalion level to mentoring at a brigade level by the end of 2013, we'll be able to see troops come home in two relatively even steps, 2013-2014, leaving probably around 5,200 troops after the end of 2013, compared with the 9,000 that we have now.
An Italian court has found Deutsche Bank, UBS, JP Morgan and Depfa Bank guilty of fraud for mis-selling derivatives to the city of Milan in a case that could set a precedent for hundreds of local governments. They have been fined a total of 90 million euros. The European Union has today proposed a near-complete ban on branding on tobacco products, saying cigarette packs should reflect the deadly threat posed by smoking. If approved by EU member states and the European Parliament, 75% of the cigarette packs will be covered with visual and written warnings. EU governments will be free to go further and ban all branding if justified on public health grounds. Britain and France are among the countries considering the idea. EU Health Commissioner Tonia Borg said the message has to be shocking to have an impact.
It is shocking, but sometimes you need shocking pictures to shock people to stop smoking as well. 700,000 citizens in the European Union die prematurely because of tobacco. This means that a city the size of Frankfurt or Palermo is wiped up out of the European map every single year.
And finally, journalists are today at risk of outnumbering inhabitants in the tiny French village of Bucarache that has been placed under lockdown by authorities, fearing an onslaught of survivalists trying to flee the end of the world. Meanwhile, Guatemala, Belize and Mexico are preparing for that momentous event, the predicted end for the Maya. Some present-day descendants of the Mayans still live in the border areas of the three countries. Tomorrow, the 21st of December, marks the end to the 5,125-year-old Mayan calendar, an event that is variously interpreted as the end of the world, the start of a new era, or just a good excuse for a party. Just to say, if I'm not here to read the news tomorrow, you'll know why. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. The time is just gone 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're with Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Now, with the election of Park Geun-hye, South Korea is entering a new era. Ms. Park is the country's first female president. Some say this may mean a new, more sensitive, liberal approach to guiding the country. Her opponents, however, are quick to remind everyone that Ms. Park is the daughter of Park Chung-hee, the military dictator who seized power in 1961. So in which direction is South Korea expected to head now, both economically and on the world stage? Well, I'm joined in the studio, I'm delighted to say, by Aidan Foster-Carter, Honorary Senior Research Fellow in Sociology and Modern Korea at Leeds University in the United Kingdom. Welcome to Midori House.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about Park Geun-hye and her very, very political blood that runs through her veins.
Such an interesting person, it must be said, and it would be wrong to define her wholly by her father. It would be equally wrong to ignore that. Yes, her father, as you said, was a military dictator. He seized power in 1961. He died at the hand of his own, shot by the head of his own CIA in 1979. Before that, Ms. Park's mother had been killed by a pro-North Korean assassin, so quite a violent background in a sense. Park Chung-hee wasn't any old dictator. He's sometimes described as Korea's Bismarck. Even his enemies, and no one is denying, including his daughter, you know, the cruelty of his rule. But he built the South Korea we know today, the South Korea of Samsung and Hyundai, that's the world's seventh largest exporter. That it was Park Chung-hee who started that by his tough methods. At the same time, so she has this political background. She was first lady for a while as a very young woman after her mother was killed. But then she sort of went into a kind of seclusion for 20 years, and she sort of come back to politics very much in her own right, an elected MP. And although she's never had elected office until now, she's shown herself brilliantly politically skillful within her conservative party, managing to please, you know, the conservatives whom she is her father's daughter, and also placate clearly enough of the people who want a bit of change.
She has got quite a large job on her hands in terms of breaking from the past, not just from her father, but also from her immediate predecessor, Lim Yong-bak.
That's right. But again, she's been rather skillful about this. In a way, one wonders how she's carried it off. She is a conservative, no doubt about that. I mean, that's the party. But she's managed to... There's no love lost between her personally and, I think, ideologically. I don't think she's pretending to be a liberal in the centre ground, between her and the incumbent Lim Yong-bak. She didn't really forgive him. She thought the nomination should have been hers 5 years ago, and he pipped it really on the popular vote within the party. He has turned out, although he described himself as a pragmatic centrist, I mean, bar humbug, I think we can say, after 5 years, he turned out, rightly or wrongly, to be quite right-wing on economic policy, on North Korea and so on. And she's been carefully distancing herself, nurturing her own faction, and in a sense has taken over the party. And he's effectively yesterday's man from now on, even though nominally he stays in the Blue House, as it's called, till February the 25th. And then she comes in, or we should say comes back in, of course.
In terms of steering the country's economy, we've talked a little bit about her father, and he created these big family conglomerates, which protected the country as a whole economically from, you know, from the outside, but really gnawed away at how South Korea should operate financially. How do you think she will deal with these?
I think you described that extremely well, and I'm not sure how far she can. Yes, they're called the Chaebol in Korea, and the household names like Samsung, Hyundai, brilliant firms, very, very many of them in terms of the products they produce on a world scale, as witness their success, but also with many flaws and just so large. I mean, they're like the sort of the giant rainforest canopy, nothing can grow underneath. Life is very difficult for small and medium businesses in South Korea. Had the other guy won, Moon Jae-in, we would have had a serious attempt to tackle the Chaebol, though it would have been difficult because the Conservative Party does control parliament all separately, which enough people haven't really talked about enough. But I do, it's very difficult because the economy does rely on exports still very much, partly because South Korean households are terribly indebted. So home consumption, home demand, you'd think in a country of 50 million people, should be a more powerful driver of growth than it is. So I think she means it. I think she'll try to do something, but they are very powerful. They've seen off various political attempts to rein them in before, and I fear they will again.
And how do we deal with the legacy of corruption, which always seems to beset anybody who assumes the role of president?
It does rather, and it'll be really interesting on that front to see whether Park Geun-hye breaks the mould. No one's been able to pin anything on her. There's an odd thing about a scholarship foundation, that some assets that her father had originally seized, but none of it has stuck to her. I fear that Lee Myung-bak, who's about to go out, will may be pursued, for there were various stuff going on before he was in office. His brother's in jail, all manner of associates are in jail. But part of Park Geun-hye's appeal, I think, is that she does seem to be pretty squeaky clean, serious, devoted to politics, without mouths to feed. She makes much of her celibacy, interestingly. She's never been married. Her private life is a mystery. Devoted to the nation, etc., etc. Considering the career discount, considering, you know, that Korea does have a real problem, corporate and government, on that level. If not as bad as some, but I mean, for a country of its standing, it'd be really good if she can break the mould on that front.
And there is something that we've been sort of dancing around on the outskirts, but haven't really talked about in depth. The fact is, she's a woman. Now, yes. One commentator has said that this will fundamentally alter the psyche of South Korea. What are your thoughts on that?
Steady on.
I know. It's
may be slightly overstated, but I mean, I am old enough to remember when a certain Margaret Thatcher was elected Prime Minister of this country, and I hated her politics at the time, and still would have a lot of criticisms, but I was kind of proud that my country had elected a woman. South Korea, probably in gender relations, this doesn't sound sort of Western and snobby and orientalist, but is probably where Britain was 40 years ago in these sorts of things. So it's incredibly important. This is a country where it's still difficult for a woman to have a full career. So you've got these incredibly able, highly educated South Korean women who come out, they work for a bit, then have families, although that's expensive too, and so on. So I think that it is quite revolutionary in itself, and it will changing psyches takes time, but it'll be a fantastic role model for young women in South Korea.
And how will Park Geun-hye deal with the fact that the region at the moment is probably more unstable than it has been for some time? China has a new leader, and there are countless spats in terms of territory, relationships with Japan are not so good, and of course the neighbours are firing off rockets again.
The foreign policy portfolio, yes, the in-tray is overflowing, isn't it? I'm sure she could do without a lot of this. But, well, I mean, she claims, and again, I don't think it's just sort of ideology and words. Within the country, she makes a great claim of being a unifier, reaching out to those she opposes. It'd be great to see if she manages some of this on the external front. She has promised trust politique, whatever that might be, with North Korea. The North Koreans have been very rude about her, considering that she actually did visit 10 years ago as a private citizen, was entertained to dinner by Kim Jong-il. How their respective fathers must have rolled in their graves or in Hades or wherever they are when that happened. So I think the North Koreans might actually come round. The question of China is a very long-term one. Of course, China is the big neighbour. China is by far South Korea's largest trading partner now, but the old alliance is with the US, and I'm sure she'll stick with that. And the Japan thing is just desperate and stupid beyond words. Japan and South Korea long ago should have mended fences like France and Germany managed, but they didn't, so it's going to be difficult. When does pro-feminism become sexism? She's going to need all her feminine powers of persuasion. There, I said it.
I think we'll leave it at that. Aidan Foster-Carter from Leeds University, a pleasure having you in the studio. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. In a moment, we examine the problems with Boeing 787.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
You're with Midori House, where the time has just gone 16 minutes past the hour. Now, it has been in operation for barely more than a year, but the Boeing 787 Dreamliner has already thrown up some gremlins. A recent United Airlines flight from Houston had to be diverted because of electrical problems, and a further two aircraft, one also operated by United, the other by Qatar Airways, have had troubles in the last month too. So how serious are these problems, and do they take away from the reputation of Boeing's and the world's most advanced commercial airliner? Well, to answer these questions and many more, I sincerely hope I'm joined in the studio by Monocle's transport correspondent, Tristan McAllister. Welcome as ever, Tristan. Tell us about these electrical problems and how big are they?
They are pretty typical with any new airplane, and not specifically just electrical problems, but when you build anything new, there's sort of a trial and error period. So it would seem that these particular issues, the press has been making issue of them, airlines have been making issue of them. This airliner got a lot of attention when it was first rolled out to the world. So I think that these issues are just par for the course.
Par for the course, but nonetheless, they really shouldn't be happening, given the fact that the great delays that stopped the Dreamliner from going onto the market were chiefly electrical, weren't they?
That was a big part of it. The airplane actually was 3 years late to market, and that was a big issue for airlines who had planned routes, who had put the Dreamliner into its growth plans, and these issues. With a brand new airplane, with an airplane that's supposed to be the most technologically advanced in the world.
This is at the heart of it. Electronics are key to making what the Dreamliner is.
Completely. It's a very electrics heavy aircraft. There are six generators on board. It doesn't rely on all of them at the same time. One thing to think about, not just with a Boeing aircraft, but also with an Airbus, they're built on redundancy. So this is something that it's not going to bring an airplane out of the sky, but it's something that shouldn't be happening with a brand new airplane.
Now, there are two current companies operating Dreamliners. One is Qatar, the other is United. Both have responded to the fact that these electrical problems have been spotted. One, however, Qatar, have come out much, much more severely on Boeing, haven't they?
Right. And just to clarify, those are two sort of big airlines running the Dreamliner, but there are many others.
There are the flagship carriers are those two firms,
right? And Qatar Airways has taken a pretty hard line on this, and this is pretty normal coming from Akbar Albaker, who runs Qatar Airways. He has basically said that this is completely inappropriate, and that they will do whatever they can to recover the costs from Boeing. And then United Airlines has said, you know, we're working with the manufacturer, we're working with Boeing to make sure that we can resolve these problems as soon as possible. Two very different approaches to public statements. One clearly is to sort of, it's a slight to Boeing. I think Albaker has also done similar things with Airbus, with the A380.
I remember when the A380 came out and that had teething problems for such a long time.
And it still does.
It still does. Yes. I mean, are we looking at, as you said at the beginning of this interview, we're looking at the fact that we have a big new plane and things are going to go wrong. And should we really be surprised by this?
No, and I think one of the things you saw with ANA when they launched service with the 787 was that ANA seemed, they were the launch customer. They were the first customer to get the airplane. They said, and they've said this in so many words in so many different places, that they knew they were going to be part of a trial and error period with this airplane. And I think that launch customers, I think that early adopters, I think it's this way with technology. I think it's this way, you know, you talk about the iPhone, you talk about anything new, there will be kinks to work out as things move forward. And I think that early adopters of an airliner need to understand that this is going to happen.
Now, you have to declare a bit of an interest here. Before coming to Monocle, you used to be a brand strategist for Boeing.
Yes.
You worked on the 787,
yes,
didn't you?
Yes, I did.
What was it like taking it to market? And more importantly, what do you think Boeing will be doing now?
I think Boeing will do exactly what it's always done, is work with airline customers to be sure that these problems do get resolved. If you think about it, one of the things that matters most to Boeing and to Airbus and to Bombardier and all these other airframers in the world is safety. That is the number one thing with their brand. And people need to be aware of that. And people need to trust the products that are on the market that the airlines use to move people around the world. So I can guarantee you that there are conversations at the highest levels, not only at Boeing, but with Airbus, with the A380 and all these airplanes that face these issues, to make sure they get resolved, because they don't want anything bad on their hands.
It is that very difficult balance that must be struck, though, which is between obviously the safety that you mentioned there, but the fact that the world's media are trained upon this plane.
Completely. And I think one thing that Boeing did, in my personal opinion, very well was position it so that it truly seemed the plane of the future. But with that came a lot of scrutiny because of the delays, because of all the attention that the airplane received. So they're under a magnifying glass. And then you have people like Al Baker of Qatar Airways making these statements and sort of exacerbating the problem. So bigger than the safety issue, I think it's a PR problem for Boeing or for Airbus, or any company who has to deal with this.
Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. The time has just gone 22 minutes past the hour. You're with Midori House. In a moment, we take a roundup of Japan's news from 2012. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, every day this week on Midori House, we've been welcoming our bureau chiefs from our outposts around the world to help us take stock and mull over a year that was in their patch. Now, today we're lucky enough to be joined in the studio by Monocle's Asia Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Hello, Fiona. Welcome to Midori House. Based in Tokyo, there have been some really big bits of news that have shaped Japan's future, immediate future, haven't there, this year?
I know we've been talking a lot about the Senkaku Islands. I'm possibly the Senkaku correspondent now, because that's been a big issue. The islands between Japan and Taiwan, which are being hotly disputed between China and Taiwan and Japan. So all three are getting involved in that. And that's really been preoccupying Japan a lot this year. It brings up all sorts of issues about Japan's defence, its relationship with its neighbours. So it's thrown a lot of things into the air.
And what's it been like trying to explore something which is so hotly disputed? And we're looking at what the Chinese have been, how the Chinese have been reacted to it. There have been anti-Japanese demonstrations in the streets. There are I think one Chinese newspaper suggested dispensing with diplomacy and just sending an atom bomb over to Japan. What was it like listening to all that anti-Japanese rhetoric?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a shock for the Japanese, because actually overall they quite like China and they go there quite a lot. I think it was a real shock to find that actually this feeling could be whipped up in no time, and these really pretty violent demonstrations, businesses were being smashed up. I think it was very unnerving for the Japanese, actually.
And how keenly was this disintegration with a bit of relationship, the relationship between China and Japan, being felt economically in Japan?
I mean, hugely. You know, all these enormous companies that really drive the Japanese economy have all had very different profit forecasts as a result of what's been happening. So it has a pretty direct impact. And yeah, I think that most people would like to see next year maybe a healing of relations, I think.
How likely do you think that is, given the fact that Shinzo Abe, the new Prime Minister of Japan, has said that not only does he want to relax constraints on the Japanese military, but that these islands are most definitely Japanese.
I mean, I think the vote for him was about the economy, and I think that is what he'll be focused on. And he knows that involves repairing the situation with China. Honestly, all the rhetoric before the election, and it wasn't even that much, but people are so sensitive to Japan and the military that any signs are really magnified, I think. But I think next year what he'll be focused on is improving relations and just getting the economies working together properly. They need to be. They're enormous trading partners, and you know, they're the second and third biggest economies in the world. So it's just ridiculous if they don't get along, at least economically. They don't have to love each other.
Let's focus on Shinzo Abe. He, former prime minister, stood down because of ill health. A party that had been in power, many say, for far too long, replaced and then back again.
Yes, I know. It's a bit of a Groundhog Day moment.
What happened? What was it like? I mean, you've been in Tokyo for some time now, so you saw him go. Did anyone ever expect him to come back?
No, we rather hoped he wouldn't reappear, actually. I mean, he was a pretty uneventful prime minister, and his departure was a really rather humiliating experience. He just wasn't well. He just really wasn't up to the job at the time. He's come back now saying, I'm going to do a better job this time. Well, you know, he better, quite honestly, because Japan is in a worse situation and people are hoping he'll revive the economy. But no, it was a bit of a surprise to see him reappearing.
What is the reaction, though, to him in terms of he has some strange thoughts about Japan's past, particularly Japan's military past? How does the Japanese palate cope with that?
You know, there are certain red flags that can be raised, and everyone knows what they are. You know, comfort women is a big one that he is very conservative on. And that is just, at the moment, he really doesn't need to be talking about comfort women. If he's trying to heal relations with China, I think the less said about comfort women, you know, and Korea as well. It's a very sore topic with Korea. I mean, overall, what you've seen this year is just how not fresh the memory of the war is, but how it still hurts. And it doesn't take much to really get these countries at loggerheads.
And finally, let's look at what the long-term after-effects have been since Fukushima, because it is we're coming up to nearly 2 years since that happened. How fresh in the minds of Japanese is it?
I mean, it's amazing to me that it's nearly 2 years. It's so fresh in people's minds. And it's interesting, when people are asked, what do you care about? You know, nuclear power it's right up there. But when it came to the election, they didn't vote for anti-nuclear parties. The two big parties, neither of them were. Well, the LDP definitely isn't anti-nuclear. The DPJ, the ruling party, as was, had a rather vague policy. But basically, I think people are very concerned about nuclear power. And, you know, they just can't go back to the way things were. They can't switch on all these reactors. And the more research that's gone into it, the more it's turning out there are some pretty serious fault lines under existing power stations. So I think it's made people think about it. And we had this amazing demonstration in the summer where tens of thousands of people turned out, and it was fascinating to see Japan mobilised in that way. You just don't see that very often.
And briefly, you know, it's been a very eventful year in Japan, hugely eventful year this year. Next year, do we have any firm predictions, or do you have any inklings about what might lie over the horizon?
It's interesting because a lot of people are wondering, you know, with a change of government, will it be any different? Well, I mean, I've sat here so many times and it doesn't change. Really, the government, I'm starting to realise who's in charge. It's almost irrelevant. Japan just ticks along. I think, honestly, I think hopefully we'll be talking less about the Senkaku. I think it will be all about improving relations. And, you know, I think really the sort of movement of popular culture could be an interesting one. I think that's where the sort of interchange between these countries is all happening. And I think you'll see more of that probably.
Our Asia Bureau Chief in London for the time being, Fiona Wilson, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Stay with us here on Midori House, because in the final half hour of the programme we'll be flicking through the pages of Monocle's winter newspaper, The Alpino, with our culture editor Robert Bound, and we'll also hear from our man in Milan who's had the terrible job of sampling Italy's finest champagne rivals.
Easy, elegant, you can drink many, many, many. It's very drinkable, it's very vinoso.
But first, with the time at just after 29 minutes past the hour, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Thank you very much, Emma. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has today made an end-of-year speech at the UN headquarters in New York, outlining his continuing concerns over global conflicts, particularly the war in Syria and Mali. Park Geun-hye will make an emotional return to South Korea's presidential mansion in February as South Korea's first female leader, more than three decades after she left it following the assassination of her father. The 60-year-old scored a decisive victory in the country's general election today. Afghanistan has today welcomed Britain's announcement that nearly half its troops will be gone from the country by the end of 2013 as part of the ongoing handover to local forces. An Italian court has found Deutsche Bank, UBS, JP Morgan and Depfer Bank guilty of fraud for mis-selling derivatives to the city of Milan in a case that could set a precedent for hundreds of local governments. They have been fined a total of 90 million euros. And the European Union has today proposed a near-complete ban on branding on tobacco products, saying cigarette packs should reflect the deadly threat posed by smoking. If approved, 75% of the cigarette packs will be covered with visual and written warnings. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. We'll be discussing this winter's Alpino newspaper next. But first, here from Stevie Wonder is what Christmas means to me. All these things and more, baby. And of course, that was Stevie Wonder there. And what Christmas means to me. You're with Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we rifle through the pages of the Alpino. Alpino, Monocle's winter newspaper, is on newsstands today. It is filled with cosy winter huts, some rather splendid ski gear, and some Siberians. But a little bit of sport has wriggled onto the pages this year. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound took me through his section and explained why ice hockey has made it onto the pages.
Because this was shoehorned in purely because I thought it looked good to have some sport on the pages.
Right.
And I think the way of talking about sport is such a kind of journalistic, writing about sport is such a journalistic impulse. It's so nice to be able to document stuff and tell the story of something that possibly lots of our readers in Europe, I mean, this is obviously Alpino, but it's obviously big in the US and in Japan and all the rest of it, wherever there is snow. Nice to tell the story of a sport, ice hockey, which clearly is, you know, on the lips and on the television screens of so many people in cold climates, but obviously never really made it to Europe quite so successfully as it did. We went to Canada. We went to Montreal.
And there is not just huge amounts of support, but huge amounts of controversy and scandal within the sport at the moment.
Yeah, so the NHL, the National Hockey League, they're on strike. There's a players' strike over pay. So their whole season has been cancelled. And so the Junior League, kind of, I guess, the sort of championship of it, English football or whatever. Anyway, the minor leagues are kind of mopping up. So they're making stars of players that were kind of in the slightly lower echelons. And these teams are cleaning up in terms of ticket sales, sponsorships, all the rest of it. So it's a sort of interesting thing. Suddenly the spotlight has been put on the more junior ranks.
A global spotlight as well. But this must have an enormous repercussion on the whole of sort of Canadian culture, one would argue, because it is so closely followed there.
Yeah. Oh, no, imagine, I mean, it would be unthinkable if the, you know, Indian Premier League cricket wasn't shown in Bombay, you know, and it would be unthinkable to think of the Premiership not being shown on British TV screens every night and on Match of the Day. It's a crazy thing to think that, yeah, these people that are that were sort of fighting for survival are now kind of, you know, the stars of the firmament.
Let's look at the piece that you wrote. You talked to us off air several times about it was the amount of vodka I think you consumed while you were on this on this trip. In the name of obviously getting it right.
<That's>
journalistically.
Right. Yeah.
So you went to Siberia. Why did you go to Siberia?
Do you really want to know?
Yeah, I do.
I made a slightly drunken bet with my mate.
Right.
That go with him. And due to the unique way that Monocle works, I said to Tyler and Andrew, this is going to be a great thing. It's going to be fabulous. What does Siberia look like in November? And they're like, yep, go. Right. So luckily it worked out. My mate Alex Preston, who's sometimes contributed to the magazine and to the radio as well, he's a novelist, and he was going out to the Krasnoyarsk Book Fair, and we did a couple of speeches in Moscow as well for the British Council.
Right.
So that was that. We got off the plane, did these kind of music, did a sort of literary salon in Moscow, then got the plane down to Krasnoyarsk, which is down in deepest southern Siberia, nearer the Mongolian border than anywhere else.
I was going to ask you, what was the journey like? Because it's a way to Moscow, and then does it become even more of a way, and then even further away, and then you suddenly think, how much further away can I actually get before I have to come back?
It's a bizarre thing. It's a 5-hour ride from Moscow, which is monstrous. I guess it's like flying from New York to LA, maybe slightly less far than that. But then you get to Krasnoyarsk, and you're still 4 hours from Vladivostok, further east in Russia. So it is, it's that you have that spooky sense. You know, when you're flying back from Asia, perhaps, and you go through Russian airspace, you do that big arc over the top of the world, it seems, and you look down and you see all those little glimmering what look like stars, but you know they're on the ground. They look like sort of like, you know, stars that have fall into the woods or something, and you wonder what those things are, whether that's just some huge mad power station or some military facility, or whether it's a city. And this is obviously one of those places. This is one of these towns that you see from your plane high at 35,000 feet.
And when you're on the ground in Krasnoyarsk, do you get the feeling that you're a very long way from anywhere, or do you get the feeling that people are incredibly self-contained and happy and don't need to travel the 5 hours back to Moscow?
Well, it's an interesting thing. There's a good quote at the top of my story, which the artist whose name escapes me. That's going to be annoying, isn't it? What is his name?
Number is it? Is it Nikolai
Rybakov? Nikolai Rybakov says, you know, that in Siberia, everybody feels like a nomad in Siberia because it's such a huge... When you come from such a huge place that's only a part of another country, you know, you always feel like a bit of a nomad. You never really get to know the whole of your county, if you know what I mean, which is a crazy thing. But I think that Siberia has always been kind of self-contained, and it has a sense of the other, I think, which I was kind of trying to explore. It does feel like constantly you're on a frontier. You know, whether you are or not, there's kind of a frontier of behaviour, there's a frontier of geography. There are, you know, obviously mountain ranges and huge rivers. So you're always on the edge of something that's stopping you from going to the next place almost.
And there are also cultural frontiers insofar. This line that you have about these, the guards in uniforms and checkpoints that constantly monitor you. Does that make you feel... Or how does that make you feel?
It's a strange thing. I mean, it you do. I mean, this was my first time in Russia. It was my first time, therefore, obviously outside of Moscow. And seeing these little checkpoints, what would have been checkpoints, and they're still used. They're still men in their fur hats with their rifles cocked, sitting in these kind of snow-covered little bunkers. And it's just an odd thing. And they're not particularly interested in you. They're not wary. We spoke to some of them. They seem to be quite friendly. They stand outside their hut and have a cigarette. But that, nonetheless, they are still all there. There's still jobs for army uniforms and hammer and sickle fur hats. Yeah, it seems in the great wastes of Siberia.
Let's have a look at your future perfect. It says, what did you call it? Your rundown.
So this is a stack thing. Yeah.
Is this a stack?
Yeah. So this
your cultural stack of what we should be up to. I'm quite attracted to the Winter Skull in Aspen simply because there's a soup cooking contest, and I think that's worth a journey.
I think that's rather nice. We've cut it into three bits this year. So we've got a kind of cultural diary. We use the word cultural lightly, as you've just talked about, a kind of soup throwing competition. I think drinking or...
Cooking, actually. Throwing would be quite good.
I think you can throw it.
You wouldn't want it too hot.
Just cooking soup for a competition. You need to, and it's something physical needs to happen. There needs to be some soup hurling.
It's not a massively active process, is soup cooking. It's vegetables in pot, cook... Maybe the addition of a bit of blending. Perhaps not. That's my world of soup. But maybe I'm getting it wrong.
Was there any soup hurling at the Monocle Christmas party last night?
Not to my knowledge, because there wasn't any soup served.
It always looks like soup when it's hurled.
there were some rather exciting balloons being flung across the room.
I've got an amazing picture, in fact, on my BlackBerry of it looking like a big cock, which is ridiculous. And Nancy Durham, also of this parish... being rather not acting,
big pink balloon?
Not acting her senior position at all when it came to the big pink balloon that yes, she got in her party bag.
One would not think that she spends her life gathering lavender in the Welsh hills, would you?
No.
I mean, give her a big pink balloon to inflate and off she goes. I saw that. I also saw Andrew Tuck as well. He was incredibly good at inflating his balloon.
Was he?
He was expert. And it went an awfully long way as well. It was shot up into the ceiling. It's fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't seen these balloons, they are those, you blow into it, as you would with many other balloons, and it inflates to about, a good 5 foot if you're Andrew Tuck, probably about 2 to 3 foot if you're me. And then you let it go and it, you know, careers across the ceiling and everybody laughs and carouses.
They were
fun.
Taking a lot of them off the candelabras at the Churchill Hyatt, weren't they, last night, with a long sort of stick, presumably invented for just that purpose.
I think, well, I'm sure they would be. Soon to feature in one of Hugo McDonald's sections in design.
Exactly.
Very briefly, we shouldn't do this, but we sometimes play in the office Snog, Marry, Avoid with the pictures
okay.
in culture.
Yeah.
We're looking at page 38 to 39.
So this is a Siberia story.
Yep. Who are you snogging?
I'm going top right, and that is, who is that? That's Miriam Sekhon, who is a sort of Franco-Russian singer.
Who are you marrying?
Who am I marrying? Mm. Oh, no. Oh, maybe I'd marry Irina Prokhorova.
Which one's she?
She's number 13, because she's the third richest person in Russia. Oh, she's married. I mean, her brother is the third richest
right,
person
okay.
in Russia.
Okay, well connected then. Marrying for love, nice to see that. Avoiding. Are we allowed to do that? It's not very nice, actually.
No.
There's a pig on a bench.
Yeah, he's not very good. You press the medallion on him, and he says something sort of quite lascivious, apparently,
right.
in Russian.
Maybe you want to snog him.
He's sort of. You're meant to have your picture taken with him if you're a girl, and then he kind of goes, "Whoa, look at you, you slag," or something like that, which is really inappropriate because it's at a children's ski resort. So it's on the junior slopes.
I think I met a few of them at the Monaco Christmas party last night. Give them a press. They say something lascivious. What's there not to love? Rubber Bound. Thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You.
And that was Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound and I possibly being a little inappropriate in our treatment of the characters within this winter's Alpino. A great little publication it is. I thoroughly recommend it. You're with Midori House. We'll be back in just a moment with some Birds of Paradise.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
The time is 1843 here in London and you're listening to Midori House. Now, Papua New Guinea has 39 species of birds of paradise and for the first time, all 39 have now been catalogued in one book. Two men, a photographer and an ornithologist, spent 9 years on the project, the first three without funding. Well, one of those men, Edwin Scholes, joins us on the line now from New York. Welcome to Midori House, Edwin. Thank you very much for sparing us the time. Tell us a little bit more about the bird of paradise.
Well, as you said, there are 39 species, and they're found actually all throughout the entire island of New Guinea and also a handful of islands surrounding New Guinea and even a few species in the northern easternmost parts of Australia.
And the fact that they are called a bird of paradise, explain a little bit more about that because, I mean, for starters, they are absolutely stunning to look at, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they got their name largely because of the way the males look. They're really incredibly plumed with feathers and colors and shapes, almost unlike anything else people have seen in other birds. And that's really how they got their name when they were first discovered and described in the wild. People thought they must have come literally from the Garden of Eden. This was back in the 16th century, and then they were thought to be birds from paradise, literally.
So how did an ornithologist like yourself at Cornell suddenly decide that you were going to devote 9 years of your life to cataloguing these creatures?
Well, I had been working on them as a graduate student, actually, for a number of years, even before that, just doing traditional behavioral research and evolutionary research within one genus in the family, traveling to Papua New Guinea, doing field work. And then I teamed up with Tim Lehman, who was the collaborator with me for the entire project. And originally it was for an article that Tim was working on for National Geographic magazine. And together we did field work for about 3 years and had pretty good success. We had made a good combination between the two of us. We spoke both Indonesian and Melanesian Pidgin, which are the two languages you need in addition to English. And Tim is an expert tree climber, which allowed us to get into the canopy. And the two of us had a lot of experience working in rainforest and New Guinea and that part of the world. So we decided, well, let's see if we can find a way to keep doing it and document all 39 for the first time in photographs and also in video recordings and sound recordings.
I'm glad you mentioned that your colleague could climb trees, because I do wonder, these pictures are not only beautiful, but you have managed to get all 39. How difficult was it? Was there at any point that there was one that just wouldn't stay still long enough?
Oh, it was difficult for very many reasons, and that's why it took us so long, and I think that's also why we were the first to do it. It's just sort of a daunting effort to get to all the different locations around that part of the world where some of these species occur. Some of them only exist on one or two small islands or one or two small mountain ranges. And of course, this is a very remote corner of the world to begin with. So even just the challenges of getting there and taking all of our gear there and then finding them and then successfully locating the places where the males were displaying and fighting the weather and the remote terrain, all that was a challenge all the way through. And then some species, like we just referenced, display at the very tops of the rainforest canopy. And so without having the ability to climb up into trees, build blinds, and sit there for hours on end, getting the kind of imagery Tim was able to get just simply wouldn't have been possible without that skill.
It must be, though, as an ornithologist, be terribly satisfying to know that you have done something unique. How possible is that nowadays, given the fact that we are cataloguing practically everything that exists on Earth, if we can?
Well, that's the amazing thing about the biological world, is that there are, you know, extraordinary things to be discovered even in our own backyards, and that's the truth of it. You know, this is a pretty exceptional thing that we've done, and we recognize that. We feel really good about it. But, you know, there are a lot of other organisms out there that could fall into the same category where no one really knows that much about them. Birds of paradise are that way. I like to think of them as being very well known of, but still really poorly known. And that was part of the motivation for our project, was to document them all, learn something about each and every one of them for the first time. But even yet, we've still barely scratched the surface. There's so much more to be done, and a project of equal scope could still be done on other aspects of their biology.
Edwin Scholes, co-author of the book Birds of Paradise, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Birds of Paradise has just been published and is 39 pages of the most astonishing photographs of the most beautiful birds. You're with Midori House. We'll be back in a moment.
This Christmas, Monocle 24 is packing its earmuffs, mittens, sticks and skis as we head up the Alps to sunny St Moritz for a winter retreat. We'll be bringing you a Christmas stocking full of shows, including The Briefing, Midori House and The Review. So join our editors and their guests for a festive spree of friends and family, debate and discussion, with plenty of mulled wine. From Boxing Day all the way to New Year's Day 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, the countdown to Christmas and New Year is fast approaching, and to ring in 2013, millions will raise their glasses filled to the brim with a selection of vintages from that greatly loved French export, Champagne. However, over the road in Italy, many locals are choosing to stay local in their choice of sparkling wine. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho popped into one of the city's wine shops to sample a taste of Italian bubbly, perfect for toasting when the clock strikes 12 midnight. Poor man.
During the holidays, Italians ring in the new year with a glass of bubbly. But unlike many of their continental neighbors, they're not always drinking champagne. Many of Italy's great wine-producing regions also make bubbly. Today we're going to try a few of those. To learn more about Italy's bubbly, I stopped in at Nomre di Vin, a Milanese wine shop and wine bar run by Cristiano Corà.
In Italy, we have three major areas of producing of bubbling, which is Veneto, Lombardia, and Trentino. In Veneto, it's very famous because of the production of Prosecco. Prosecco in the region is near Venice, and the method is Charmant. All the wine has been processed in stainless steel tank. It's very light. It's very common because they use Prosecco also for spritz. It's a normal wine. In Lombardia, the region is Franciacorta. Franciacorta is very similar to Champagne region, to Champagne area. The only difference is the temperature, the weather, because in France the Champagne area, the Champagne region is more cold. In Lombardy it's a little bit warmer, but the grape is the same, the processing is the same of doing the wine, and the wine is similar. The difference is usually the grape are used are Pinot Bianco, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. In France with the Champagne they use also as well Pinot Blanc, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. We don't have Pinot Meunier in Italy. So essentially the wine is very similar. We can't call Champagne because of the area. Champagne is called Champagne because it stays in the Champagne area. In Italy we call Franciacorta because the name is the wine is belongs from the area, so Franciacorta area. Franciacorta is very near from Milano, is only 1 hour from Milano, near the lake, Iseo Lake.
Okay, Cristiano, we're going to try the Franciacorta first.
Yes, this is Bella Vista, 2004 Vittorio Moretti selection, one of the best spumante in Italy we have, one of the best Franciacorta spumante. This wine has been made from the Prima della Scala on the 7th December of Lonegrin, and every year we will have the same wine, the same vintage, but with a different dégorgement.
Okay, let's try this.
Okay.
That's a very subtle opening.
Yes, very smooth opening. Let's see in the glass.
I notice you're using not champagne flutes, but these glasses, they're tulip shaped.
Yes, actually it's tulip glasses for champagne, because it's better to have a little bit bigger glasses, but for every wine, because if you taste the same wine in a small glass or in a big glass, the wine change at all, especially because you smell all the flavors. So it's better to use always big glasses.
Okay, this is a very nice bouquet. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers.
Now, what I notice, it seems to be less acidic than champagne, but this is just...
It's very creamy. It's creamy because... This is 100% Chardonnay.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to the Prosecco. So what do you have for us?
This is actually not a Prosecco, but it's a Cartizze from a producer called Varaskin. Cartizze is very near to... It's the same region of... the same land, especially of Prosecco, but a little bit... is also Prosecco, Cartizze. It's cru. It's like to say Grand Cru of Prosecco. The production of Cartizze is very, very small. It's around 1.4 million bottles per year. Prosecco is around 150 million bottles per year. So it's very, very limited.
Okay, so walk me through this wine.
Easy, elegant.
Yeah.
You can drink many. A lot of, you can drink even. Also, the percentage of degrees of alcohol is very low. Around 11, so it's very drinkable, it's very vinoso.
So I see on the wine list to drink and also for sale, you have champagne, of course, Krug, some smaller producers.
Of course, we have all these big brands, but we also champagne like the Villepin, belongs from a relative of the former prime minister in France.
And that's your house champagne?
Yes, since 10 years.
So while Italian bubbly is becoming more popular, champagne still holds first place.
Yes, we have a lot of time to learn, a lot of time to build, to make wines, a lot of time to drink, but maybe in the next 200 years we will be like the French.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Poor Ivan Carvalho. You're listening to Monocle 24. Time now to hear a little bit of music before the end of the show. This is James Brown. Santa, go straight to the ghetto. Tell him Hank Ballard told me so. Santa Claus,
go straight to the ghetto. Never thought I'd realize I'd be singing a song with water in my eyes. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto.
And that was James Brown and Santa Go Straight to the Ghetto. That's all we have time for today's episode of Midori House. My thanks to our producer Dawn Trump, our researcher Pilar Lopez, and our studio manager Sam Impey. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs. Here's a sneak peek.
We're working with a lot of brands that try to do things in Spain, and the Made in Spain is a very important thing for us because the economy is in the situation that it is, and we want to develop the country now, so we have to work with the brands that are working in Spain.
That's these Spanish entrepreneurs taking a guerrilla approach to rescuing the country's economy. Don't forget, in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Ted Kravitz and myself will be back for the Monocle Daily. Robert Bound will be in the hot seat for tomorrow's Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening.